Today's sponsor of Does Not Compute is Linode. They let you deploy and manage SSD-backed servers in just seconds. You get to pick your favorite Linux distribution, how much computing power you need, and which of their 8 data centers your machine should live in. With plans starting at just $10 per month and the ability to spin up new servers in less than a minute, they've got you covered whether you're building a personal site, a massive app backend, or anything in between. Servers are all billed hourly, so you only pay for what you use. You get full root access to every VM you spin up on Linode, which means you can do tons of stuff with them, like run Docker containers, encrypt the disk, set up your own personal VPN or Git server, or just about anything else you can dream up. Everything is running on SSD storage and a 40 gigabit network, and the hosts are powered by Intel Xeon E5 processors. So this is real server-grade equipment. The best part? If you head over to linode.com/doesnotcompute and sign up with the offer code doesnotcompute20, they'll give you $20 in credit. Make sure to check out Linode today and use that offer code doesnotcompute20 when you sign up. So Rails 5 seems like it's getting pretty close to release, Sean.
Do you have any ideas as to when that might actually happen?
So Beta 3 came out at the end of February, which makes me think that we're probably getting very close to a release candidate.
That's really cool. I've been hearing lots of really cool things. One of my coworkers, Josiah, keeps talking about it. I'm actually looking forward to what it has to offer.
Yeah, I mean, it's got some awesome stuff. Obviously, the headliner feature is going to be Action Cable, so you can finally do a lot more real-time stuff in Rails apps way easier than in the past, and that's going to be great. But there are also a lot of, you know, smaller little things that are just kind of cool additions to the framework.
Right. I was looking through the newsletters that I get blasted with every week, and there were a couple of cool, like, pretty short posts about a couple of things coming up with Rails 5, but I thought they were really great. More so than what they actually did, I liked the feeling it gave me, like developer conveniences. Like, this is nice as a developer to have. And I think the first one was maybe one that I sent to you, but it was an article by Big Binary talking about how Rails 5 now adds console warnings when you do things like fetch an active record collection that's probably way too big.
Right. So you can basically just do, you know, user.all, and that will actually retrieve every single user out of the database. If you have thousands or millions of users, that's basically going to crash whatever machine you load it on, because it'll try to load all that information into RAM. So now if you're trying to grab something that's probably too big, and this is, of course, configurable, but Active Record will actually warn you when you're doing that, which is awesome. It's such a reflection of the stuff DHH was saying over the last few months with the Rails doctrine, where you want to optimize for programmer happiness. Let's not make this thing for computers. Let's make it for people.
Right. And I really, really like that idea because I'm one of those people that when I'm building stuff, I tend to get moving quickly and I might gloss over things that might not be best practices. Like, I might load like user.all or something like that and just not think about it because my mind is churning on something else. But when I'm checking the console logs, you know, having that reminder like, hey, you did this and you probably shouldn't do this, that's potentially going to save me a lot of debugging time down the road.
Yeah, and this isn't just a one-off thing either. This is something that's very core to not just Rails, but Ruby as a whole. I think this, you see this a lot with a recent version of Ruby 2.3, I believe. There was actually an addition where if you typed something that looked kind of like another method name, it would say, hey, wait, did you mean this thing? And it's just there's so many little additions like that, both in Ruby and Rails, that are just really, really focused on making humans have a better time writing code, because that's what it's all about. And I love to see that. There was actually a second article from Big Binary talking about another one of these Rails 5 features where there's actually an accessed fields attribute that you can call now. So if you have a object that you've loaded into memory and you use it in a template, you can actually call accessed fields on it later to find out which properties were being used. So let's say, for example, again, if you have a user and they have a first name and a last name and an email, but you're only using their first name in a template, you can make your query a lot shorter and reduce memory usage by only plucking that out of the database, just getting that name instead of returning everything and then only using part of the object. So this is a really easy way to go through and say, okay, this page, I could maybe improve the performance here. Let's see what's actually happening so I can get a better sense of what I can improve.
Right. The example was actually a user controller, and the template has an index page. And in the template, the author is pulling out name and email only. So I'm sure that the user has many more attributes. But in the controller, you can use the method access fields, and it'll tell you the only fields that were used, like you said, Paul, were name and email. So that way you can do something like user.select name and email, and suddenly you're only requesting the information that you actually need for that view. And that's great for performance gains, because it's something that you can do relatively easily. It doesn't take you a lot of work. You don't have to think about it. You can just run access fields and figure out exactly what you need and only send that across the wire. And I love this because, you know, we've talked about in the past, Paul, not trying to optimize prematurely, not spending a lot of time before you actually have a problem. And this just goes right along with that idea. You know, it's just a quick method that you can slap on something and you get a quick result that, you know, over time, if you do this a bunch, it will lead to performance gains across your entire application.
This all comes back to something that, you know, I think we're both really passionate about, which is making sure that all of the code and software that we make is actually designed for humans. And I know we talk about this a lot, but I feel like people really need to consider this when they're building things. When you're building even a developer tool like Rails, or if you're building a JavaScript plugin or whatever that is, it's going to be used by people, not by computers. Obviously, computers are executing the code, and you need to care about performance and all that sort of stuff. But really, your end users are humans. And that's such an important thing to keep in mind.
Well, I think that's part of what makes things like Elm, for example, pretty popular, or something that really intrigues people is they see something like the Elm compiler that does a lot to actually help the developer fix any errors or catch any errors. And I mean, the fact that people are really into that idea, and I mean, I see people tweeting about it all the time, you know, I think that speaks to that even more. You know, developers really enjoy when someone's building a tool that actually helps them in programming, in writing better code, in catching errors.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's kind of the same draw that people have to IDEs. I mean, that's why you were trying out the WebStorm and the JetBrains IDEs a while back, because developers really do want things that make their lives better and easier and simpler. But so many times things become overcomplicated because the people who make them are trying to develop for computers instead of for people.
Yeah. I mean, I think the biggest reason I didn't stick with JetBrains stuff was performance on my Retina computers. I think it performed a lot better on non-Retina screens, but when I was using it on my Retina computers, it just got slower and slower over time, which is a bummer. But there were a lot of features that I really enjoyed and I wish that I could use on a daily basis. I just can't deal with the spinner, Paul.
So while we're talking about making sure you build things for humans, I actually came across this super awesome JavaScript plugin called multiple.js. What's really interesting about this isn't so much what it does, although what it does is pretty cool. It'll allow you to have a bunch of elements floating on a page and then have a background that kind of shows through all of them without them actually being transparent, if that makes sense. So you can kind of have different colors and overlays of on top of a single image to display data or whatever else you might need to do. Kind of hard to explain, but we'll have a link in show notes so you can take a look at this. What I thought was really awesome about it was how the concept was explained. Instead of just saying, here's how this thing works, how it actually is set up is that it's blurred out and it says, here's the problem I was trying to solve. Think about how I might have been able to do it with just CSS. And you actually have to click in order to see that. Which is awesome because it makes you think a little bit and you learn, hopefully, you learn a little bit in the process. And then after you get to the bottom, it's like, okay, that was pure CSS, but that actually doesn't work on mobile. How do you think I might have fixed it there? Here's what the problem is. What do you think the solution is? And you have to click again for that. You actually are taken through the entire exploratory process where the developer was learning about how to implement this thing, but you get to relearn that along with them, which is super cool.
The only reason that I read it, all of the documentation on this page was because this author was blurring out the CSS in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. And there's just so many little nice flourishes on this page. I really recommend checking it out, even if you don't care about the plugin itself. The way you're walked through it obviously is great, but there's also just nice little things like icons next to Stack Overflow and CodePen links, which I think is really cool, and some nice little animations. So it's just a great page, and something I think people should be looking at because it feels very human, even though it is something that solves a developer problem.
I think actually my favorite feature of this page, Paul, has nothing to do with the plugin itself. But in fact, when you see the little row of toggles, so you can turn off different settings for this plugin. And when you click on the actual label for the toggle, it does what you would expect. And that's something that, you know, a lot of people, when they make checkboxes, they will make the label. When you click the label, the checkboxes are checked. But when I see little UI sliders, that's often not the case. I think this
is the bane of my existence.
Yeah. This is maybe the first example where I've seen someone do like a custom UI element, like a toggle slider, where you can click on the actual label to toggle. This is my favorite thing right now.
So yeah, we'll definitely have a link to this in the show notes. Everybody go check it out because it is super awesome. And it really kind of reflects a lot of the things we've been talking about lately on the show, which is great.
So Paul, on the same vein of developer conveniences, I've been pushing into the Node world a little bit over the past maybe a few days. So I made a site that basically randomly picks a guitar exercise for me to practice. So in the mornings, before work, I usually practice my guitar, and I don't necessarily want to sit down and try to put a routine together in the mornings because my brain might not be going yet. But rather, if I can click a refresh button and get a random exercise, I can do that. So my thought was, why not build a site where I can add a bunch of exercises, and when I click on a button, it just gives me a random one, and I practice that for 10 minutes. So originally, I built it with Statomic, and it's great, but I'm finding that I want to do some more customized things with forms, which might be a little difficult to do in Statomic, and I also kind of figured I don't really have much Node experience. In fact, any application that I've built has been a Rails application, so I'm having that grass is greener feeling, maybe. Like, oh, Node is popular and trendy and whatever. So I decided to rebuild this thing in Node.
Sure. I mean, especially for passion projects like this, it's always kind of fun to explore new technologies and see what you like and don't like about them.
Yeah. But I have some thoughts, Paul, especially after, you know, talking to you a little bit earlier and we were talking about Rails 5 features and just the convenience type things. I just kind of, I don't know, I felt sad. Maybe sad is the wrong word, but I was like, oh man, I won't have access to that. Granted, I don't have like a Node mentor. I don't have someone that I can go to and say, hey, you know, what should I be doing? But I did a fair amount of Googling and I decided to give happy.js a try. And I believe originally it was built off of Express, but basically it's built by Walmart Labs. And the idea for Happy is to have conventional reconfiguration, whereas Express is kind of pretty bare bones and you can build what you want. Happy has some more conventions built into it and has features built into it that Express doesn't ship with. So I figured that would be a good fit because I'm used to Rails and I'm used to the decisions being made for me.
That kind of sounds like in the Ruby world, the difference between Sinatra, which is very, very plain and doesn't give you too much and you build out your own custom stack on top of it, versus Rails, where all the decisions have been made for you and it's very opinionated.
Right. So once I decided on Happy.js, you know, I went through a few tutorials and made a basic app, and it was pretty simple, you know, pretty bare bones. And then I thought, well, you know, what kind of database should I use? I've heard some decent things about Mongo, and I've heard many bad things about Mongo, so I decided to not use that. I don't think I need a document store for this anyway. So my old faithful is Postgres, just because I'm used to Rails. So I Googled Node ORM and I got about 1 million results.
Oh, so Happy doesn't provide an ORM by default?
Not that I'm aware of.
Interesting.
Yeah. So as far as I'm aware, it provides the server architecture. It doesn't really provide any connections or ORMs or anything like that. I could be wrong. And if I am, somebody call me out, but I didn't see it in the documentation right away. But yeah, so I typed Node ORM into Google and got a ton of results, which is fine. You know, it's perfectly fine. But I felt overwhelmed. So I clicked on four of them and opened them in new tabs and started looking through documentations for them. And they all seemed relatively the same, but they were just different packages. So then at that point, I'm like, well, what do I do? Which one do I pick? I don't know anyone that maybe might know an answer. I could join a random Slack, but I don't know that person either. You know, I don't know if what they're doing is quality. I felt kind of stuck, if that makes sense.
Sure. I mean, yeah, that's always the issue, is you go into a language or a framework or whatever that is, and you don't know who the valid voices are to listen to. you don't know who's worth paying attention to and who actually doesn't know what they're doing. So that makes it super hard because you see all these open source projects, and some of them might have a beautiful landing page, but they're actually terrible. Or they might have a horrible landing page, but they're actually great. And you just don't really have any way to know without becoming at least competent in the idioms of that language or framework, and then inspecting the code yourself. Or spending a lot of time in the community and figuring out over time who knows what they're talking about. It's very intimidating when there isn't a clear choice right from the beginning, like there is with Ruby. If you're writing a web app in Ruby, you're probably going to be using Rails. That's just the way you do it. Of course, people do build things out in other tools like Sinatra, etc. But in the Ruby landscape, there are generally accepted ways to do any given thing, which makes it a lot less intimidating to new developers.
Well, for me, it made it a lot more accessible. If I needed to know how to do something, I could find it in the Rails docs. My stack wasn't split up between a bunch of different modules, you know, so I didn't have to figure out which module to use, and then if that doesn't work out, I don't have to swap it out. You know, I just know that it's a thing, it's part of Rails, I can use it, and it's probably going to be pretty okay. And if not, then I can swap it out. But in my experience, there hasn't really been anything with Rails that's just been terrible. I haven't had to do that. So, I mean, I know a lot of people like the idea of Node and how you can basically choose the different parts of your application. And I guess, you know, maybe once I become more familiar with it, I'll enjoy that as well. But for just getting into something, Rails made it almost so easy. You know, it's kind of interesting. Like I said, you know, I've never built a project out in Phoenix, or I've never built an actual application in Node or something like that. So I'm sure part of what I'm experiencing is just kind of growing pains, you know? But also, I just know that I'm going to miss a lot of things from Rails.
I think whether or not people like Rails or Node or whatever else, beyond the actual differences in the language or framework, is personal preference. It kind of comes down to a similar thing like iOS versus Android. iOS, things are very decided for you. Things are going to be a certain way. Android, you have a lot more flexibility, but in some cases, to unlock that flexibility, it takes a bit more effort or knowledge. And they're both valid approaches, but it's something that is very personal in a lot of ways. And that becomes tough, especially when you're working with a team at a company to decide what language you want to use or what framework you want to use, looking at all these things and having opinions about them, but everybody else also having opinions about them. So I think it's important to remember that a lot of these things are pretty subjective, whether it's a plus or a minus to have to pick out more parts of your stack.
That is a really important thing to remember, that everything is subjective. I think what was interesting to me about Node, beyond, you know, not having built anything and only being familiar with Rails, was that it was just a different world. Like I said, grasses are greener. You know, I read blog posts and people are like, oh, Node is great and it's fast and it's easily scalable, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that, you know, that's kind of what pulled me in that direction in the first place. And plus, this is a side project, and I think it's good to experiment every once in a while and explore a little bit. I think it's good for learning, and I'm sure I'll learn things that I can pull back into my client work with Rails. So I know I always promise that I'm going to do stuff on the shows, but never do them. But, you know, I think I'm going to stick it out with Node this time. I'm going to build this thing out in Node and just see what happens. So if any of the listeners have any tips for me, just ping me in Slack. I will be very grateful.
Okay, so we had Mr. John Gold as a guest on the show pretty recently, and we spent a lot of time in that episode talking about CSS, because CSS is surprisingly difficult to work with. I think that's probably a bit of an understatement.
I would say it's unsurprisingly difficult to work with.
Unsurprisingly difficult to work with. Okay, fair enough. CSS is really hard, and people over the last couple of years especially have been realizing this and trying to figure out what to do about it. And one of the big movements that has come out of this is what some people call atomic CSS, or utility classes, or functional CSS. And I like the term functional CSS, so I'm going to use it, but call it whatever you like. So functional CSS, I have finally been giving it a real try with some new projects that I'm working on. It still feels really weird to me sometimes. Like when I go in and I have to write a couple new classes because I'm still building out this code base for something so weirdly specific, that still feels really strange to me. But overall, I think it does make a lot of sense, and it's felt great, really, in the end.
Well, you said something that was really interesting to me earlier this week, Paul. Out of the blue, you said, hey, it's just composition over inheritance. And I was like, what are you talking about? And you said, functional CSS, it's just composition over inheritance.
Right. And I mean, people have had this epiphany before. Obviously, that's kind of how we ended up here in the first place. But for me, that just kind of finally really clicked as I was using it a bit more. It was like, oh, right. Yeah, that's why this totally makes sense. Because yes, you are writing more HTML, but that's actually a way more sensible place to be writing that sort of logic. And HTML is very easy to reason about. It's very easy to see well-named classes and know exactly, just from one file, know exactly what something is going to look like, or at least have a very good idea of what it's going to look like. And that feels great. That feels awesome.
Yeah, that was the huge kicker for me, honestly. So I started using Base CSS a while back. And at first, I mean, I was kind of like dabbling in it, trying to not let anyone know what I was doing. You know, like I was hiding in the corner with my cookies. I just started working with it. And the more and more I used it, you know, the more I broke things into components and partials, the happier I was, because I could look at this partial and I could see exactly what it was going to be. I mean, granted, I had to get familiar with Base CSS first and how the classes are structured and all that. But now when you look at a component or a partial, you can see exactly what this thing is going to be. You don't have to wonder if by looking at a class, how many times that's getting overwritten or how many times it's referenced in different files or even different media queries. It's kind of all right there, which is my favorite thing. And so I've been using functional CSS now for a few months, I want to say. And recently I had to jump back on a couple of projects that a subcontractor worked on. And I had a really hard time at first because the code wasn't particularly organized well. So there were tons of files. There were lots of mix-ins in each file. And then in some cases, there were selectors that were overriding mix-ins, which made it even harder to debug.
Oh my gosh. I think this is a Thomas Fuchs joke, if I'm remembering correctly, but basically he said some CSS walks into a bar and a bar stool in a totally different bar fell over.
Yeah, exactly.
It sounds a lot like that.
Yeah, it's exactly like that. And so what I ended up doing was basically trying to read through as much of the CSS as I can at first. So that way, when I was looking at the markup, if I saw a class, I could kind of remember where that was. But even then it was difficult because there were a few files where, and this was written in Sass, so you'd have your parent selector, like maybe a case study list. And then inside that parent selector, there were a bunch of different child selectors for different pieces of that list. And then there were about 7 different media queries at the bottom that was overriding all the things above. And that made it incredibly difficult. So when the designer would look at this thing and request a tweak, like, this isn't looking exactly like how I thought it should, I would have to go through and look at the non-media queried CSS and then scroll all the way down and look at the media queried CSS. And then figure out how they're affecting, because it wasn't just a max or a min, they were mixed together, which made it even more difficult. And granted, you know, a few of these problems were created because best practices weren't being followed, but I find it tremendously more approachable when I'm looking at the HTML and I recognize that a CSS class isn't going to be overridden. When I'm looking at the HTML and I recognize that all the properties that are happening, like all the CSS that is being applied to this, is just right here.
So I think the biggest takeaway, at least for me, about all this stuff is that functional CSS as a concept has kind of moved up a level to one of those things where I'm actively trying it, and so far I'm liking it, so I'm going to keep trying it. And I think that if you are feeling unhappy about the CSS that you're writing or the CSS that you're working with, this is something that might very well be worth looking into. Obviously, that's something you'll have to decide, you know, for yourself and alongside your team. But it definitely seems like a reasonable approach.
Yeah, it's totally a reasonable approach. And, you know, one thing you'll hear a lot of people say is that why would you totally kill the cascade if that's how CSS is meant to be used? And my response is typically, you don't necessarily kill the cascade with functional CSS, because you can use classes on parent elements and that property might cascade through as CSS does. But what it does is it removes any really complicated cascading from the equation. So you just don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, and the other side of that point is CSS initially came out in 1996. We're like almost 20 years out from when CSS was released. So, you know, some of the ideas that may have seemed great for very simple documents that were on the web in 1996 maybe are less great than we initially thought, and that's probably okay.
It is okay.
Thanks to the good people at Linode for sponsoring this episode of Does Not Compute. Linode is one of the easiest, fastest ways to spin up virtual machines for whatever you need. You get full root access, so you can do just about anything with these boxes. Encrypt the disk, run Docker containers, set up a Minecraft server, or whatever else you come up with. Make sure to check out linode.com/doesnotcompute to learn more, and sign up with the offer code DOESNOTCOMPUTE20 to get $20 in free credit. If you haven't rated or reviewed the show yet on iTunes, we'd really appreciate it. We'd also love to chat on Twitter at DNCcast, or better yet, on the Spec Slack. You can sign up right now at spec.fm/slack.
Oh my God, what's that word, Paul?
What?
Composition. Composition, that's what it is. I forgot the word.
I thought you were looking at the dock. Okay.
No, I'm staring out the window.
Okay. Let's try that again.
Yeah.